our differences worldwide would vanish if we were facing an alien threat from outside this world. And yet, I ask you, is not an alien force already among us?
Exopolitics, paranormal phenomena, and deep analysis of current world events. From somewhere in the desert, between Area 51 and Roswell, blasting across the planet, the Manticore Network proudly presents Veritas, because the truth will set you free.
Headline edition, July 8, 1947. The Army Air Forces has announced that a flying disc has been found and is now in the possession of the Army.
It was too fast to be an airplane.
I think it's time to open the books on the question of government investigations of UFOs. We ought to do it really because it's right. We ought to do it because the American people, quite frankly, can handle the truth. And we ought to do it because it's the law.
Be skeptical. Do be as skeptical as you want, but by all, don't close your mind.
Greetings to everyone around the world and a warm welcome to another edition of the Veritas Show, where you listen because you don't want to believe, you listen because you want to know. I'm your host Mel Fabregas and I sincerely thank you for tuning in once again. A special welcome to you, our new listener. If this is your first time, make yourself at home and welcome to the Veritas family. If you need to get in touch with me with comments or questions for me or our future guests, send an email to mel, that's M-E-L, at veritasshow.com. Tonight's special guest is none other than John Lear, who lives on the moon, and many other fascinating topics. If you're listening to this show prior to 9 p.m. Mountain Time on Friday, February the 13th, you're welcome to join me for our first chat right on our website. Just go to veritasshow.com and on the show info link, find chat. I will be there to meet you if you are awake in your part of the world. Remember, the Veritas Show now has a Facebook page. Join us there. Also, the Veritas Show video contest is still going until March 31st, where you, the audience, will vote for the winner. To give you more of a general idea, I posted 5 new promotional videos which you can watch on the Facebook page or on the video link of our website. I heard from some listeners who are in the process of submitting their video, and we're looking forward to receiving them. Next week's special guest on Friday, February the 20th, is Sergeant Clifford Stone, UFO Crash Retrievals and Technology. If you listen to his interview on Coast to Coast AM, expect much more this time. Remember, we're unscripted, uncensored, and uncut. Now to some news. I found a piece of interesting news, too long to read, but it's now posted on our blog with the title Moon Base Photo, Set Scene by Top Security Air Force Veteran. A very appropriate article since we'll be discussing the moon a lot tonight and what could possibly be up there. And since today is Friday the 13th, I thought I'd share with you some interesting data. Friday the 13th makes those of you who believe in luck a bit nervous. And today is only the first of 3 Friday the 13th this year. Mathematician Thomas Fernstler says, quote, "I know more than probably anybody really wants to know about the number 13. Unquote. For instance, a year like 2009, with a triple set of Fridays falling on the 13th, typically only comes around every 11 years. Also, the 13th day of the month is more likely to fall on a Friday than any other day of the week. those who share the phobia about 13 have a connection with some prominent historical figures. Napoleon, Herbert Hoover, and Franklin Delano Roosevelt all feared it. Frenchler thinks this is normal. Quote, "If you're not superstitious, maybe you should be. 87% of all the people in the world are superstitious about something. The other 13% are liars." Unquote. Here are some reasons why. The first person to die in a car accident was killed in New York City on September the 13th, 1899. The British Navy built a ship named Friday the 13th. On its maiden voyage, the vessel left dock on a Friday the 13th and was never heard from again. The ill-fated Apollo 13 launched at 13:13 Central Standard Time on April the 11th, 1970. The sum of the date's digits is 13. The explosion that crippled the spacecraft occurred on April the 13th. Quarterback Dan Marino wore number 13 throughout his career with the Miami Dolphins. Marino is said to be the best quarterback who never won a Super Bowl. Butch Cassidy was born on Friday, April the 13th, 1866, and Fidel Castro was born on Friday, August the 13th, 1926. Very interesting, isn't it? Let's take a quick break, and when we return, our special guest, John Lear, joins us. Who lives on the moon? And many other topics. You will hear things on this interview you have never heard before. So buckle up and get ready for a great ride with this speed record breaking pilot and fascinating man. You really don't want to miss this. Don't go anywhere. John Lear, 66, retired airline captain and former CIA contract pilot with over 19,000 hours of flight time, over 11,000 in command of three or four engine jet transports, has flown over 100 different types of aircraft in 60 different countries around the world. He retired in 2001 after more than 40 years of flying. Son of Learjet inventor Bill Lear, John holds more FAA Airman certificates than any other FAA-certified airman. John flew secret missions for the CIA in Southeast Asia, Eastern Europe, the Middle East, and Africa between 1967 and 1983. During the last 17 years of his career, John worked for several passenger and cargo airlines as captain, check airman, and instructor. He was certified by the FAA as a North Atlantic Navigation Check Airman. He has extensive experience as command pilot and instructor in the Boeing 707, Douglas DC-8, and Lockheed L-1011. John held 17 world records, including speed around the world in a Learjet Model 24, set in 1966 and was presented the PATCO, Professional Air Traffic Controllers Association Award, for outstanding airmanship in 1968. He's a senior vice commander of the China Post 1, the American Legion's Post for Soldiers of Fortune, a 25-year member of the Special Operations Association, and member of Pilots for 911truth.org. John has four daughters, three grandchildren, and lives with his wife of 38 years, Las Vegas businesswoman Mary Lee Lear, in Las Vegas, Nevada. What an impressive resume. No doubt this is going to be a classic and fascinating show. Hello, Mr. Lear, and welcome to the Veritas Show. How are you?
Hi, Mel. Just fine, and thanks for inviting me back.
John, for the few in the audience who may not be aware of your background, I'd like you to spend a few moments sharing with us some of your courageous efforts, adventures, and anecdotes from your days in Southeast Asia. Can you share with us some of that part of your life?
Yeah, I went to, I started to work for a contract pilot for the CIA in 1967, And what we were doing was ferrying O2As and O2Bs, which were the Cessna push-pull airplane, which were used as forward air control. And in those days, they had they needed the aircraft so quickly, they didn't have any, number one, any boats to put them on, and it would take too long to get there. So they just formed a group, a cover company, and hired a bunch of us, and we flew them over there. I did that for on and off for 4 years, and I took 10 airplanes over. We'd go over the route. We'd leave Wichita, Kansas, where they were built, and make one stop on our way to Hamilton Air Force Base there in San Francisco. Then we'd go to Hickam Air Force Base in Honolulu, and from there to Midway Island, and from there to Wake, from there to Guam, to the SAC base there, which was called Anderson Air Force Base. The other runway is Aganya, and that's the big Navy there. And then from there, we'd go over to Clark Air Force Base in the Philippines, and from there, in country, we land at Nha Trang, about halfway up the coast there to the DMZ, and we'd pack up some of the stuff we were going to take back. Now, we didn't take back the tanks, the extra ferry tanks, but we did take back the pumps and the HF radio and the life rafts. And we'd hitch a ride down to Saigon, and we had a commercial ticket back. We'd always go through Hong Kong to get a little R&R, but we had to stay in Saigon for 3 days under house arrest. And the reason was is because there was no customs and immigration in Nha Trang, and we didn't carry military ID because we were CIA. So they put us under arrest, kept us there for 3 days, and then let us take an airline out and come back and pick up another one. And that was really enjoyable. Then in 1972, I went to Cambodia to fly Convair 440s. They were ex-Finnair. Finnair is an airline in Scandinavia. And these were Convair 440s. They had they were in immaculate condition. They had the old CB, not I mean the old, they had the great CB-17 engine, and we had 115, 145 fuel over there, so we could use water injection, and could pull as much as 63 inches of power.
And now, John, was that during your time with Continental Air Services?
No, after Cambodia, I went up to Laos and flew for Continental Air Services, and I flew the Twin Otter and the C-46, and it was great. It was great time. It was exciting times. I flew 560 missions. Half of those were combat missions, and it was very interesting.
And for the listeners, Continental Air Services Inc., known as CASI, was formed in 1965 by Continental Airlines when the government suggested a less visible air transport alternative to the CIA-associated Air America. Can you tell us about the courageous and fierce Hmong tribesmen in Laos and their bravery and loyalty to their U.S. allies?
Yeah, the bravery and loyalty. We supported them. General Vang Pao was their leader, and the CIA supported them until finally we lost. I think the last flight was made in 1975, and a bunch of the Hmong have settlements all over the United States. I recently went to one. I used to fly with a pilot named Dave Kuba, and he was with me when we got shot down in a Twin Otter in central Laos. And he came to live in Las Vegas after, you know, he retired, and he was there so long in Vincian that the Hmong gave him a formal burial ceremony, and it was very, very touching. It lasted about two or three hours. It was a very ceremonial, had ceremonial dancing and speeches. It was really nice. That was about a year ago.
Were you ever wounded, or did you come close to being shot down?
No, we got shot down. What happened is we were running into we were delivering ammo, and what we do is because we're working in such close quarters there that flying a Twin Otter, we had six loads of ammo, and we'd fly real low over the troops that we were dropping to, and the kicker was the guy working in the back, and he'd push it out, and we had what they called G7 parachutes, and they'd open instantaneously to reduce the impact. And what happened is either Dave didn't hear because he was flying, or we missed the call, but for whatever, we were supposed to turn sharp left after the drop, and we waited just a little bit too long, and they hosed us down with AK-47, which hit a fuel line in the strut, which shot the engine out. And so we headed back to, we were working out of a place called Lima Site 69, Vang Dieng, not Vang Dieng, can't remember the name of it. And on our way back, there was a huge, the cargo door is open in the Twin Otter, it's always open, it's just a hole in the airplane. And what happened is where it shot the fuel was pumping out of the strut, and because of the wind flow, it was pumping into the cabin. So I wanted to call Cricket, and the Cricket is the airplanes in airplanes that worked at high altitude and took all the communications. And if anything went wrong, you'd call up Cricket, say, Cricket, this is Papa Golf Victor. We've been hit, and we're headed to Lima 16. And for any of you guys that have flown in Southeast Asia, you'll always remember the Cricket would come on and he'd say, this is Cricket on guard with an airstrike warning to all aircraft. Avoid the areas, Tango Gulf, uniform Sierra from the time 0700 to 0800. This is Cricket on guard out. And anyway, we were very fortunate. We managed to make it. I had the option there of calling Cricket, but I just wondered if I pressed that microphone button, since it was so much fuel and foam, or fuel and fumes coming through the aircraft.
Spark.
I thought it might spark it, but
right.
I held the microphone real close and just gave him a message, and we made it.
John, in hindsight, what was your opinion of that war and how it was pursued?
With hindsight?
Yes.
Yeah, well, with hindsight, you know, the war in Southeast Asia was for the express purposes of the propagation, cultivation, and sale of
heroin,
drugs, yeah. Heroin and poppies. The same reason we took over Afghanistan. All that war was about was securing the Hindu Kush in the northeast part of Afghanistan. That's the only reason we're there. The fact about Taliban and Al-Qaeda being terrorists, there's not a shred of truth to that. If you want my opinion, the only terrorists there are Israelis acting as Taliban and Al-Qaeda. But anyway, the poppy output in 2001 was, according to New York Times, in 2001 was, I think, 14%. And then, according to them, in 2007, September, it had risen to 94%, which is it has now. So the reason it's so important is the secret government, that's where they get their cash from. That's why they don't have to go to Congress and say, hey, we'd like some money, here's why we need it. They don't have to mess with Congress. They just cultivate, distribute, and sell the illegal drugs themselves. And when you think about it, it's not such a bad deal. I mean, they do it in conjunction with Military Intelligence 6, which is the CIA equivalent over in England. And, you know, when you look at it from a practical standpoint of view, you don't want some guy like Dr. No or some mafia guy handle those trillions and trillions of dollars. You'd rather have your own guys being the bad guy, right?
That's exactly right. You eliminate your competition, create a monopoly, and you control the price.
Yeah, and then they have every once in a while they'll have a staged bust, you know, where they'll bust several hundred pounds. And I think there was a funny deal here just lately, a G2 or something crashed in Bolivia or even in the United States, I think, with a full load, you know, of 4 or 5 tons of cocaine, and everybody was trying to deny it. But it was pretty hard to do because it was a U.S. registered airplane. Nobody went to jail, you know, that kind of thing.
You probably heard Catherine Austin Fitz. She's a financial expert. She says the drug war is the most efficient war we've ever fought because we keep the prices up and we control the competition.
That's what wars are about.
Exactly. Have you revisited that area where you spent so many days and lost so many friends?
In Southeast Asia?
Yes.
No, but Dave Kuba did. And Dave was my good buddy who passed away here a year ago, and we had a Laotian burial ceremony. And he went back, and he brought back some videos, and they're really good. You know, good videos of the Plain of Jars, which we used to refer to as the PDJ. And there's these ceremonial jars that are up to 10 feet in height, and they're gigantic stone jars, and nobody knows who made them or how they made them. And he got to go to a couple places. The only place they couldn't go was Long Chin, and that was the super secret CIA base that we had our main operations out of. Dave did get to have a quick glance as they flew over it on the way back to Vientiane from the airport that they were at, but that's all he got.
I get an email, by the way, John. We are heard by people in 90 countries. And one U.S. historian who lives there in Vietnam now emailed me to let me know that he's been studying the medieval Vietnamese tribes, and they believe in interdimensional beings even until this point. Do you believe in that, too?
Oh, absolutely.
What was it like flying night drops over the jungle, the clear night skies so full of stars but so full of potential danger, too?
That's the only thing I never got. I never got a night drop in the year that I was there, and I was scheduled for several, but and it was a very lucrative deal because you got paid in cash, and you know, you didn't have any ID or anything, and they were called night drops, and sometimes they were simple, sometimes they were complex, but I never got one, no.
Did you ever get a chance to visit the ancient ruins, some of which allude to gods from the skies and stars?
No, they were under communist control then under the Khmer Rouge up at the Siem Reap. And I just read an article the other day about how interesting it is these days, and how that, you know, it's so modern, and they have the nice little bars there, and everybody's so polite, and they have the kiosks and everything. And, you know, all I could remember is being war-torn, everybody getting shot, and that. It's just, you know, it's amazing how what a difference 35 years makes.
We never thought we'd be drinking tea with the Japanese, and now they're our friends. Did you ever hear or see for yourself any of the Foo Fighters phenomenon so common in World War II?
No. You'll talk about strange lights. I only saw a couple of strange lights. One was on descent over Palm Springs going into Los Angeles, and it was in, I believe, 1966. I was in a Learjet. I'd just been cleared to descend, and I was doing the descent. It was in the afternoon, beautiful, clear day, and I saw this thing, an object. It looked like a bathtub, and it was going from left to right and under me. And I thought, hey, that's one of those M2F2s, you know, the ones that the $6 million man got crashed in?
Right.
I even remember calling the chief pilot at Learjet, whose name was Hank Beard, and unfortunately just passed away about 2 weeks ago. And I remember calling him up and said, hey, you'll never guess what I saw the other day. He said, what? I said, an M2F2. And only 30 years later do I realize how utterly ridiculous that is, that a highly test experimental airplane should be flown through the main approach corridor of Los Angeles. I mean, it's just ridiculous. It's not going to happen. So that was clearly unidentified.
Did your dad ever witness any UFOs in his years of flying?
Yeah, I think he did. He was seen one or two, but you remember back in those days, as I was growing, I was born in 1942, so when the UFO flap came in, oh, like 1952, 1953. My dad was so involved in that UFO stuff and anti-gravity stuff with, you know, the top guys in that time. Well, General Hoyt Vandenberg was a very close friend of my dad. Also, Randy Lovelace of the Lovelace Clinic in Albuquerque, and Jimmy Doolittle. All those guys were around the house. So, you know, my dad was up to his ears in the UFO and alien stuff. But in, I believe it was 1953, he made a trip to Bolivia, and he made a public comment that he believed UFOs were real, you know, and someday interplanetary travel would be possible. And I guess they came down on him, Mel, like you wouldn't believe, because he never said another public word. And, you know, he was so involved, they didn't expect him to do something like that, but he was very outspoken. And I guess they just went to him and they said, look, Bill, we've been friends for a long time. You ain't say anything like that again, and you'll be okay, but we'll kill Moya, we'll kill your kids, we'll kill your dog, we'll kill your parakeet. But you'll be okay.
So he never talked again?
He never made any public comment ever again on it. But I just talked to some people recently who live in Wichita and did work for him at that time did work on the anti-grav stuff. And as you know, the anti-grav stuff has been real since 1956. You know, we have all kinds of anti-grav craft that fly all over the place, but it's never discussed. And nobody ever brings it up. You'd think that Aviation Week in Space Technology would at least say, hey, what's going on with anti-grav, you know? But no, there's not one single word. And the reason is it's real, it's true, it goes on. I'm sure the B-2 is full of anti-grav, and so is the F-22, is that the new one? I forget. So those things, you know, that's the stuff we see, but the stuff that is really secret, we never get a chance to see.
Well, I've heard that, I think it's the F-22, supposedly has electromagnetic anti-gravitic systems in place.
Yeah, yeah.
When you get together with your Special Forces buddies at your China One gatherings, what is the atmosphere there?
It's about the, you know, talking about the old days. I just met with, we had the reunion of Continental Air Services there in Reno about 6 or 7 months ago. And it's usually just about, you know, the guys that passed away and the funny things that happened over there. We, you know, when we were flying, there's never, ever any discussion about weird stuff or UFOs or any of that type of stuff, at least when I've been around.
Can you tell us what planes you usually flew, and did you have a favorite bird?
In my life?
Yes.
I think I flew about 160 different types of airplanes, and they all held
wow.
some kind of romance, some particular, you know, love. You know, the last airliner that I flew was the L-1011 Lockheed TriStar, and that's one of my favorites. I flew the F-104A Lockheed Starfighter just before I retired, and that was the first time I went Mach 2. And, of course, the Learjet is very, very close to my heart, although I didn't fly it all that much. I have about 1,800 hours in it. And, you know, most of those airplanes all had some wonderful part, you know, something that I particularly liked about it.
You know so much now from alien ships around Saturn to moon bases. It's a plethora of information that you have. What perspective has it given to you since the war in Indochina to now?
Well, you know, when I was, that was in the 70s, early 70s, I knew nothing then. I knew of no kind of conspiracies or anything until 1985. And, of course, now I'm still learning stuff, you know, hand over fist. But, you know, in the last year, it's become absolutely ironclad, lead pipe cinch that we faked Apollo. There was no Apollo mission. Nobody went to the moon. It was all faked. And I have, you know, hundreds of pages of data, videotape, everything. As a matter of fact, I just got through reading a book called One Small Step, The Great Moon Hoax and the Race to Dominate Earth and Space by Gerhard Wisniewski, German author. And, you know, I have a bunch of those. Apollo was a hoax book. But this guy puts the final nail in the coffin of the Apollo hoax. It did not happen. And the way I came across that, Mel, is about 9 months ago, a friend of mine, Ron Schmidt, who runs our website, thelivingmoon.com.
Great website, by the way.
Sent me three NASA video videos of the landings. It was Apollo 14, 15, and 17. He said, take a look at these and tell me what you think. And I looked at those, Mel, and I said, holy smokes, we faked the whole damn thing. So I got the other ones. I got 11, 12, and 14. and looked at all six. And from a pilot's perspective, from a photographer, video photographer's perspective, it was just fake from the get go. You know, and the main thing is, as you're descending out of, it says 30,000 feet, you know, the craters don't get any bigger because what they're using is that fake 22-foot fake moon that NASA had back at Langley Research Center. And they, you know, they had all the craters painted on it just like it was. But if you're faking a, you know, coming down from 30,000, you know, to landing, the perspective, the diameters of the craters aren't going to change. As they would in real life. You know, if you're in real life, they're going to go from really, really tiny to, you know, huge that you can actually land in. So that was the kicker for me. And, it, you know, when I looked at that thing, I got a sickly feeling to my stomach saying, oh, my God, we've all been hoaxed. And so one thing led to another, and I just had to, I realized that, boy, that other than 9/11, that has to be the biggest hoax on mankind.
So, John, you believe the Apollo mission was one small step for man, one giant hoax for mankind. Hold it right there. We're here with John Lear on The Veritas Show. I'm Al Fabregas, and we'll be right back with much more. Stay with us. Show, ML Fabregas, and I'm here with John Lear. John, let's take a few minutes to get your opinion of two men. First, your father, the legendary Bill Lear. I realize that in your lectures, you have discussed your tumultuous relationship and your division over the development of his last project, the Lear Fan. If this is not too difficult a subject and too personal, I think our listeners would be curious of the personal impact and revelations that must occur when you're exposed to such a renaissance and energetic but type A personality. Your father, who had no formal education, was an inventive genius. His interests ranging from radio to airplanes, wire recorders, prefabricated homes, and steam-powered cars. I bet many didn't know this, but your father had 150 patents. And though he was best known for founding the Learjet Corporation, the first manufacturer of business jets, he also developed the A-Track system, which was widely used in the 60s and 70s. In the 1920s, your father and a partner, Elmer Wavering, invented the first practical car radio, calling it Motorola. He developed radio direction finders, autopilots, and the first fully automatic aircraft landing system, and his Learavian series of portable radios, which incorporated radio direction finder circuits, as well as broadcast band coverage. And ahead of his time, in 1968, your father also started work on a closed-circuit steam turbine to power cars and buses, and built a transit bus and car using this turbine system. John, I don't know why, but the name Nikola Tesla comes to mind right about now. Your dad was quite a busy man and a tireless inventor. I can't imagine it was both exciting and difficult around your house. What was it like for your mom and you and your siblings to move and to be involved with such a whirlwind of change and never-ending pressure and adventure?
Well, you know, over the years, and he's been gone now since 1978, so that's 88, 98, and 30 years, and feelings soften and you forget the hard times and everything. And I often think if I could just be given 10 seconds to tell him something, I think I'd say, Dad, I still think you were an asshole. No, there was a lot of hard things going on, and when you're that close to a program, you know that he's taking a lot of credit for a lot of things everybody else did. When you went to work for Lear Incorporated, just like every other company in those days, you were required to sign a release that, you know, anything that was invented while you were there belonged to Bill Lear, you know, Sr. So, you know, a lot of that stuff he didn't do. I don't think he gave enough credit to the guys that actually did it. Elmer Wavering could give you a few words on that, but so could a lot of other people. But there's no doubt that, you know, he did make the achievement. He is credited with it, and the Learjet certainly was a fine achievement. It started out as a pusher airplane. Actually, it was going to have two pusher airplanes, and a lot of people think that that was the first business jet. It wasn't. The first business jet was the was the Lockheed Jetstar. And the second one was the North American Sabreliner. And then came the French Marine Saunier. And I think there was one other before Learjet came along. But the Learjet was the one with the most pizzazz and the biggest name and everything. And that's why everybody referred to any type jet as a Learjet. And that's why they always say, oh, yeah, the Learjet was the very first one. Your dad had the vision to go out and do it. Well, to some extent, you know, that's not exactly true, because there were four or five other business jets out there in the field.
Once again, this reminds me of Tesla. He invented the light bulb, but who was the one who took credit for the light bulb?
Let's see. Edison took
credit. Edison. Correct. And John, one other provocative person we would like you to discuss is Ingo Swann. Have you met Mr. Swann and perhaps delved into remote viewing, which he was so instrumental in formalizing?
I'm deeply involved in remote viewing. I've had a formal course, lengthy course, with Angela Thompson. And Angela Thompson Smith, I think.
Right.
I see her occasionally. I also see Ron Blackburn, who's into remote viewing. I've read Ingo Swann's book, I'd Give Anything.
Penetration.
What did I say?
Penetration. I love that book.
Yeah. Penetration. It's got so much interesting things in there. And it was just, you know, it's kind of, if you could say a book so technical, was written from the heart. It was written, hey, this is what happened to me, you know, and here it is in print. And I love that book. And now Ingo, I've heard, is as of a year ago moving out to Las Vegas. Whether he does or not, I don't know. But if he does, I sure hope I get a chance to meet that guy.
I can't wait to ever have a conversation with Ingo. I know he's very secluded lately, and he doesn't want to grant any interviews. But you mentioned Penetration, which is actually one of my favorite books. It's an out-of-print book with plenty of demand. I can't understand why the publishers wouldn't want to reprint it again. I've seen it selling for $500 on Amazon.
Absolutely. $500 for that book. I don't know.
You revealed in Coast to Coast AM on a chat some time ago that you had studied with Angela Thompson Smith. You just mentioned her, a remote viewer instructor. How did that go?
It was absolutely interesting, because I am the guy that can't tell when the telephone was going to ring. I can't tell when my wife's mad. I have no, secret ability of knowing what's going to happen, in the next minute or anything that. And what I wanted to do is find out if, and this is after I read Joe McMonagle's book, Mind Track,
yeah.
I wanted to find out if I could do that, because they were saying anybody can do it. It's just the degree of ability that you're able to actually do it. So I took a course with her, and I'm telling you something, Mel, I think it was either the second or third day, I was shocked at what I could do. And I still have the stuff that she was having us draw, because, you know, you draw stuff. she puts a National Geographic photo in a plain brown non-see-through envelope, and then you take a crayon or a pencil and you draw what's in there. And I was doing it, and it was completely shocking. I wish I'd have had time to pursue it, but I've just got so many other things. And at that time, I was still flying as an airline captain. So, you know, I just didn't have time to devote to it as much time as I wanted to.
Same with me. I started courses with Major Ed Dames. What do you think of Major Ed Dames?
I will reserve that opinion so that I don't hurt anybody's feelings.
Granted. What targets did you remote view, and did you attempt to see ETs on the moon or the moon?
No. No, we did some attempted remote viewing of Area 51 and S4, and I can't remember the other stuff, but I know what I did. We used to have an outbounder. Every day we'd pick one in the class, and he'd leave the house, and we'd all sit there and write exactly at what time he was seeing. And I nailed that. And it was just an interesting course. I would recommend it to anybody that has the time. You're not going to get anything in 3 days. I took the 7-day course, and I was very satisfied with it.
John, during your interview with Project Camelot last year, in April of 2008, in Las Vegas, you mentioned in some detail the tragic death of astronaut Gus Grissom and his crewmates Chaffee and White during a ground test in 1967. And you implied that it was actually murder, or at least deliberate negligent homicide or manslaughter, since the powers that be allowed the tragedy to unfold. I found this background on Grissom. Grissom was an easy scapegoat, as he had been falsely accused of, quote-unquote, screwing the pooch on the second suborbital Mercury flight, Freedom 7, when the explosive bolt fired prematurely, leading to the loss of the capsule and almost in the drowning of Grissom himself, even though he had been a brave fighter pilot with over 100 combat missions over Korea. It is well known that Grissom and his crewmates had worried and complained about a fire danger and shoddy work on that first Apollo. Grissom going so far as to hang a lemon on the capsule just the day before that fatal, horrible fire. And that even in a 1966 editorial in the Journal of Space and Aeronautics, it was asserted that safety protocols for the Apollo project were thoroughly lacking. Can you discuss those events briefly and why you think that the fire was allowed to happen and delay the Apollo program and eliminate a rather vocal thorn of an astronaut?
Well, of course, Apollo was a hoax. It never went. And Gus Grissom could see that. He made the statement, hey, look, this thing ain't going to the moon in 2 years. This thing ain't going to the moon in 10 years. And he was right. It wasn't going to the moon. They were using that money. They were faking the Apollo, and they were using that money for a orbiting weapon system platforms that are in use today. There's between 8 and 12 of them orbiting around the Earth, controlled by USS SATCOM or STRATCOM. And at least one of those weapons was used to destroy the World Trade Center. But Gus Grissom was very outspoken, and they knew they had to get rid of him because no other way they were going to shut him up. And they wanted to get rid of him in such a way that everybody else would look at that and say, uh-oh, I better not say anything wrong. Now, one of the interesting things is that during that fire, there's a fourth astronaut in there who was part of the secret secret space program.
Right.
And the others, the astronaut, I hear this comment all the time. They say, you couldn't fit another astronaut in there. Well, that's BS. There was plenty of room down there by the environmental I think they call it EVM machine, and you put your head up on the on the console and your feet down into where they kept the moon rocks. But anyway, the reason they had a fourth astronaut is because he would help. He had a complete knowledge of the system, and they would help him unravel it as they were running into all these problems. Now, the fact is, the guy that was supposed to be there was Joe Shea. Joe Shea was head of ASPO, and for some reason, whatever it was, Joe Shea had to be in New York, and so they put this secret astronaut in there, and I don't know whether the guy that put the secret astronaut knew they were going to kill him or not, but he did get killed. And the reason any report you read about Apollo, first of all, when the doctors got there, after they got the doors open, the astronauts were still breathing. But they sent the astronaut. They told the doctors that the astronauts were dead, and they just left. And the reason they had to do that is they didn't want anybody else to find, the doctors to find, that there's a fourth guy in there. And what happened is when that fire happened, National Security Agency, which is the one that's over NASA, locked down that whole area there, and they became in total charge for the 2 hours it took to get the fourth astronaut out. And then when they got the fourth astronaut out, they had to put everything back exactly as if that astronaut hadn't been there. And that's why any report you read on the Apollo 1 fire says that it took 6.5 hours to get the astronauts out. Well, the reason did is just what I've said. You know, there was another guy in there, and they had to be sure there was no discovery of that guy. Now, I have the name of that astronaut.
And you do?
I'm not going to disclose it.
Oh.
But, and what I do is keep that name until I find somebody who can confirm it. Now, at the last San Jose UFO conference about 2 years ago, a lady came up to me after my talk in which I told this story, and she says, John, I can tell you you're right. I'm close with one of the astronauts' families, and I'm not going to tell you which one, and they say that they knew there was a fourth astronaut. And I said, well, thank you for that confirmation.
It's incredible that they were breathing. I didn't know that. They were breathing when they opened the door, if you will.
Yeah, they were alive for about 15 or 20 minutes after they said they were dead.
It was 100% oxygen there. So I heard that their suits actually melted on their skin. That's how bad it was. But why would there be a simple... That was only a test. Why would there be a fourth person there?
It was very complicated. I mean, they were trying to make these guys, these Chaffee, White, and Grissom, think that they were actually going to the moon. And at that time, I think there was 20,000 squawks on that thing. They were so far behind, they had to work, you know, night and day just to make people think that they might do it, which they weren't going to do it. The plugs out test is everything except launch.
I had Dr. Egan Mitchell a couple of weeks ago, and I asked him why he thought we won't return to the moon until 50 years since the last time. And he basically said that Kennedy, during his famous speech, actually gave the speech to make the Russians think that we were going to, but we were not prepared. This was a 21st century deal, not a late 60s or 70s deal. Your thoughts on that?
Ed Mitchell is a really great guy, and let me think here. Let me see if I can put my hands on. Hold on. Can't find it. I wanted to find and read his book, that page 4 at the bottom of the page. I think it's called In the Way of the Moon or whatever. He says, you know, in the times I go around to talk about my experiences on the moon, I'm always asked two questions. One is, how do you go to the bathroom in space? And number two is, what does it really feel like to be on the moon? He says, you know, I never have any trouble with the first one because I realize, you know, I tell him about how we have the diapers and the pads and the foams and the sponges. He said, but as to the second one, how does it really feel like? I can't remember. Now, those are his words.
The same thing. Buzz Aldrin, that's exactly what he says. He doesn't remember.
Buzz Aldrin throws up when he tries to think about it.
Why do you believe they say that? Is it mind control, or are they just told not to?
It's mind control. We didn't go. We didn't go, but they couldn't tell the astronauts that we didn't go. They had to pull some kind of super advanced mind control, which they had available to them at that time, to say that, you know, we did go, you felt fine, it was a wonderful program, everything was going great, you know. But, you know, it's ridiculous. Apollo 6, I think, was the first Apollo launched as a practice. They had 20,000 squawks. Apollo 7 launches and there's zero squawks. Apollo 8, they launch and it goes around the moon. It's ridiculous. Apollo 9, they launch, you know, and they do a couple more tests. Apollo 10 goes and does a low pass at the moon. Apollo 11 goes, no problems. Other than Apollo 13, there's not one single problem on the whole program. Now, I believed it, you know, but I don't anymore.
Do you think that the fact that Dickie Slayton has stated, and since it was well known at the time, that Gus was to be the first man to be honored with stepping on the moon in the Apollo program, not Neil Armstrong, that this contributed or led to his being seen as a dangerous wild card by a program who needed or wanted to be sure of 100% astronaut control to avoid any leaking of the alternative space program and other lunar realities?
I hadn't heard that story, but I'm going to check on it. It sounds interesting to me.
Do you have an opinion as to why North American Rockwell has been given the Apollo contract rather than McDonnell Aircraft, who had successfully built and managed the Mercury and Gemini systems?
No, but I knew the answer to that question. I can't remember what it was.
Was it a political decision or part?
Yeah, political, and I don't remember what the answer was.
Or a deliberate diversion, distraction maneuver, right?
No, yeah, it was political, something to do with it. And, you know, since I started this investigation, Mel, last year, and I realized they hoaxed it, I've read darn near every Apollo book, so I know quite a bit about that program.
So much of the work was shifted to inexperienced production managers and engineers in Governor Reagan's California and other novice locations in politically powerful states, which surely contributed to the shoddy and dangerous engineering mistakes on Apollo 1 and possibly Apollo 13. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, they did. They documented a lot of that in one of the books I read, talking about the, you know, going out for martinis at lunch, you know, and beers, you know, in the afternoon and stuff like that. I mean, that contributed a lot to the problems they had.
Was the purpose to make spaceflight appear so dangerous or expensive or even exotic as to make the possibility of a more successful and advanced program seem impossible or unfathomable by a world population first horrified by the incineration of the Apollo 1 crew and the near loss of Apollo 13? And even the glitches on Dr. Mitchell's Apollo 14, where the lunar module docking had to be done manually to overcome a near mission ending glitch? What do you think was the real reason?
No, the reason for the faking was to pull the money off for what they were really trying to do in conjunction with the Russians. You know, the United States and the Russians have always been together. There was never any Cold War. That's all BS. We were always working with them in conjunction with them. And we do have the secret space program, which I told you, the orbiting weapons platforms that have all those interesting platforms. And we see the space shuttle go up today, and we're told that the International Space Station has 3 people in it, and we see the space shuttle go up with 7 people. That's so much BS, Mel. They've got, I think, it's my personal opinion, right now, Stratcom, or whatever the new operation is that controls the astronauts of the Army, of the Navy, of the Air Force, and NASA, I think there's about 5,000 current qualified astronauts. Now everybody thinks, oh, the shuttle is the only thing that's man-rated. That's not true. I mean, they have Zenit 1, Titan, Delta. They have several others that launch people up to the different places they go. And what tipped me off on this was that last September, one of the shuttles goes off, and as usual, we wait 3 days for it to dock with ISS.
Right.
And so I got to thinking with Ron Schmidt. I said, "What do you think's going on here?" And he said, "Oh, well, you know, they have to open the doors and cool the thing off, and then there was the I forget which forum I was on, might have been, I can't remember, but oh, maybe it was ATS, and we had those bozos on there that Jim Oberg and those guys, and they say, oh, well, yeah, they had so many checklists to do. And I'm thinking, checklists? Listen, pal, I'm a pilot. I mean, 72 hours of checklists to dock with the International Space Station that you're, you know, all it is 9 minutes to orbit from Kennedy. That's all it takes. And now I got to take 72 hours of space. So I got to thinking, not only that, but, you know, when it undocks, it's exactly 54 minutes from the International Space Station to landing at Kennedy, but it always takes 2 days, at least 48 hours. What's going on here? So what we did is we finally figured out that what it was doing. Oh, and the other thing that fit into this puzzle was that whenever the cargo bay door would open at the International Space Station, it would always be at least half empty. So what we finally figured out is as soon as it took off, it was hooking up with these other orbiting weapons platforms and unloading food, technicians and supplies, and it, you know, get the first five or six before it had to dock with before it had to dock with the International Space Station. And then we found out that just coincidentally, before the shuttle would dock with the International Space Station, two Progress, Russian Progress missiles would dock with the station. So what they were doing is, you know, the shuttle would dock up there, they'd unload all the stuff that the Russians had shot up there, you know, and unload that into the space shuttle. That's why you never find any notes, recorded landing weights of the shuttle or anything, what it really lands at, because it's, either extraordinarily light or extraordinarily heavy.
I'm sure everyone who's listening agrees that time and cargo space on the shuttle must be very valuable, every minute and every inch. However, it takes the crew 3 days, that's 72 hours, after launching to rest and open the doors. I agree, it seems absurd. But are you telling us here that there's a secret space station that the shuttle docks with first and unloads cargo, and that's where the 72 hours are spent? 72 hours are enough for more than one space station. Do you believe there's more than one?
Yeah, there's between 8 and 12 of them, in addition to the International Space Station. And what they've been doing is building those since 1968. In 1968, the Aquila cargo rocket was launched from Kwajalein. And a lot of people think that in terms of launch facilities as Vandenberg and Kennedy, and I think there's other one. In fact, there's 24 major launch facilities around the world, which include Australia, Melville Island. I mean, they're all over the place. And yes, there are between 8 and 12 orbiting laboratories. And you can, on the livingmoon.com, you can see John Leonard Walsam's pictures of those orbiting weapons.
John, we have to take another break. When we come back, I want to ask you about reverse engineering technology that we may possess. This is Mel Fabregas, and you're listening to The Veritas Show. Stay with us. Thank you very much for listening. We're going to talk more with our special guest in our members section. Head on over to our website, veritasshow.com, click on subscribe, and join us in the members area to tune in to the second part of this great show. We'll take a short break, listen to some music, and we'll be right back with more.